This is Audible.
Oasis Audio presents Soul Surfer by Bethany Hamilton. Read for you by Eleni Papageorge. Foreword. To be honest, I never wanted to write a book. It actually took a lot of convincing by my family and friends, because I'm not someone who likes to talk a lot about myself or thinks I'm any big deal. But they saw something in my story that would be helpful and interesting to others, and they encouraged me to write it down. So here I am. And actually, when I really think about it, it seemed like something that I should do. It would give a bigger picture of my faith, my family, and all those people who have helped me get back into the water again. But I'll tell you one thing. It wasn't easy. It took a lot of people to help me put my thoughts on paper. First, there was Rick Buncha, my spiritual advisor and a pastor in the Kauai Christian Fellowship Church. There were certain things I just didn't want to talk about, certainly not to a stranger. So Rick volunteered to do the translating. We would sit for hours and just talk. I'd pour my heart out and he'd patiently listen, putting it all down on paper. Then came our writer, Cheryl Burke, who helped me organize and shape all these thoughts into 15 chapters. Who knew I had 200 plus pages in me? When you're really close to something, it's hard to see things as they truly were or are. So Cheryl, along with my editor, Lauren McKenna, helped me connect the dots. They asked the toughest questions, stuff that really made me squirm sometimes, but also, in the end, made me dig a little deeper and really be honest with myself and you. In the end, I'm really proud of what we've written here. I think it's truthful, and I hope it inspires and motivates people to tackle any obstacles in their lives. I hope it helps people find faith in God and in their own strength and ability. I hope it motivates someone going through a tough time right now to keep on fighting until they rise above it. You can and will get through it. I'm living proof that where there's a will, there's a way. What I don't want is for people to pity me or think of me as a person who has had her life ruined. That's not how I see it. My mom is always saying, if life hands you lemons, make lemonade. Which is a great outlook on life if you can actually see beyond the lemons when you're up to your eyeballs in them. My strength came from my relationship with Christ and from the love and encouragement of my family and friends. In a lot of ways, I'm like any 14-year-old girl, and in a lot of ways, I'm not. If someone had told me that this is how my life would be, I would have never believed it. It would have seemed too bizarre to be true, and sometimes it still is. I often dream that I have both my arms again, and I wake up expecting the whole shark business to be a nightmare. But it's not. It's my reality now, and I've learned to accept it. I've moved on. I don't pretend to have all the answers to why bad things happen to good people, but I do know that God knows all those answers, and sometimes he lets you know in this life, and sometimes he asks you to wait so that you can have a face-to-face talk about it. What I do know is that I want to use what happened to me as an opportunity to tell people that God is worthy of our trust, and to show them that you can go on and do wonderful things in spite of terrible events that happen. I don't think it does any good to sit around feeling sorry for yourself. I made myself a promise. I'm not going to wallow or walk around moaning, woe is me. One other thing you should know. This book really doesn't have an ending yet because I'm still learning how to cope every day. I'm not talking about learning how to button my top with one hand. I'm talking about coping with being a celebrity, something I never imagined that I would have to deal with at the age of 14, or coping with people's stares, either because they recognize me or because they're not used to seeing a person with one arm running down the beach, or coping with answering endless questions from the media and seeing my face in newspapers and magazines. I'm also learning to cope with the frustration of knowing that if I had both arms to paddle, I just might have done a little better in a surf contest that I have just been in. I'm excited about some of the opportunities to travel and surf all around the world that have come as a result of my attack and return to surfing. But most of all, I am excited about what the future holds. Will I make it to the pro ranks in surfing? Will my lifelong friend and surf buddy Alana be paddling next to me in the years to come, as she is now and was during the attack? Will I be able to make a difference, in some small way, in people's lives by sharing my story? What does God have in store for me? I really don't know, but I do know one thing for sure. The adventure has only started. Chapter 1, Halloween Morning. It came literally out of the blue. I had no warning at all, not even the slightest hint of danger on the horizon. The water was crystal clear and calm. It was more like swimming in a pool, rather than the deep ocean waters in Kauai, Hawaii, where I go almost every morning to surf with my friend Alana Blanchard or the other girls on the Hanalei girls surf team. The waves were small and inconsistent, and I was just kind of rolling along with them, relaxing on my board with my right hand on the nose of the board and my left arm dangling in the cool water. I remember thinking, I hope the surf picks up soon, when suddenly there was a flash of gray. That's all it took, a split second. I felt a lot of pressure and a couple of lightning-fast tugs. I couldn't make out any of the details, but I knew that the huge jaws of a 15-foot tiger shark covered the top of my board and my left arm. Then I watched in shock as the water around me turned bright red. Somehow I stayed calm and started to paddle toward the beach. My left arm was gone almost to the armpit, along with a huge crescent-shaped chunk of my red, white, and blue surfboard. A morning like any other. It was still dark, about 5 a.m. when my mom, Sherry, cracked open my bedroom door, peeked inside, and called, "Wanna go surfing?" Before I had a chance to even open my eyes, our Sharpay Ginger jumped on my bed with her own wet good morning kiss. It was my usual surfing wake-up call. I was hoping for a perfect surfing morning. It had poured for the last 3 days, but I couldn't hear the sound of the rain plopping on the big elephant ear plants outside my window. Yes! Perhaps the storm had passed and the warm tropical sunshine would be back today. I lay there in bed for a few minutes more, listening to my mom start her morning ritual. First, she flicks on the living room television and switches to the local island weather channel for the report while she brews a strong cup of coffee. She listens very carefully, not just to the forecast, but also to the buoy reports to tell of swell activity. Then she translates all that info into a plan for me. She plots out where the best surf will likely be hitting the island. I reached over to the nightstand and turned on the lamp switch. My lamp is pretty cool. It has a clear base that I filled with shells. In fact, my whole room is full of shells. I have a blue shell bedspread, shell necklaces, and boxes overflowing with my shell collection. I was once asked what I would grab if my room was on fire. No contest. I have lots of cool knickknacks and dozens of trophies from winning amateur surf contests, but I am sure the first thing I would grab would be my beautiful sunrise shells. Their name explains their color. Sunrise shells are rare and hard to find in one piece, but they are the most stunning shell that any beachcomber can find on Kauai. I know lots of girls agonize over what outfit to wear to school or on a date. Me? I always obsess over what bathing suit to put on for a surf. I have at least a dozen different choices hanging from knobs on my dresser. Ah, the perks of being a surfer who's sponsored by a major clothing company, in my case, Rip Curl. My eye caught something black in my closet. Black trousers that I had bought at a thrift store just a few days before as part of a Halloween costume. My best friend, Alana, got a pair too, and we bought funky black shoes to match. We would be the Mexican Mafia, a costume idea we just made up because it sounded silly, and we'd go dressed alike to the Halloween party at church and then off around the neighborhood. Then it hit me. Today is Halloween. Halloween in Hawaii is a little complicated. Unlike on the mainland where people carve their pumpkins a week before the holiday, here it's so warm and humid, you only get a day or two to display carved pumpkins before they grow a moldy beard or cave in on themselves in a slimy mess of goo. While I got ready, the rest of my family was waking up, too. I could hear my dad, Tom, banging around in his bedroom upstairs. A lot of times my father would go surfing with me. He and my mom were the ones who taught me to surf. But today, he was going into the hospital for an operation on his knee. The surgery wasn't supposed to be very complicated. He wouldn't even stay in the hospital for the night. Still, someone, my mom or one of my two older brothers, Noah or Timmy, would have to take him there and drive him home. I put on a red, white, and blue bathing suit to match my red, white, and blue surfboard and came from my downstairs room into the living room. My mom was already waiting with her keys, purse, sunglasses, video camera, and a bowl of Raisin Bran for me to eat on the road. I think she gets as excited as I do about surfing. That's because from the time she was my age, she's been a surf nut, too. "There isn't much showing on the buoys," she informed me. "Maybe we should check Pauika. I heard it was pretty good there yesterday. Actually, I like Pauika a lot. Pauika is a surf spot located almost at the end of the road on the north shore of Kauai. It gets its name from the circular shape of the waves, and also because it's really fast and has a hollow wave, so sometimes the ride feels just like you're exploding out of a cannon. It's for experts only because the waves can be very powerful and a bit dangerous. Surfers judge the quality of a wave by its shape. The more the top or crest throws out to the bottom of the wave, the better. This makes the wave form a little hole that a surfer can pull into called the tube. The quality is also judged by the length of the wave. A wave that breaks in a line is much better than a wave that breaks all at once, and Pauika has both a good shape and a long ride. My dog Ginger tried to come with us to Pauika. She always wishes she could come along for the ride. So I scooted her back inside and then tried to find my rubber slippers. People on the mainland call them flip-flops. They were buried in a pile of shoes outside our front door. Taking off your shoes before you go into the house is a firm custom in Hawaii. Nobody has shoes in their closet. They're all out on the front porch. This tradition is probably something left over from the early Hawaiian days, or something the Japanese immigrants who moved here a long time ago to work in the cane fields brought with them. It was still very dark when we jumped into our beater. Many people think that surfers drive around in those old wood-paneled station wagons like they see in surfer magazines or in old Beach Boys videos. In truth, most hardcore surfers in Hawaii drive what everyone calls a surf beater. It's an older model car with lots of rust, faded paint, and if you're real lucky, free cockroaches. These are the kinds of cars that you don't mind loading with sand, wet towels, bathing suits, melted wax, and surfboards. It just kind of contributes to the car's charisma. Ours is a 1988 Dodge Caravan with a cracked front window from being knocked hard by a too-long surfboard that my dad purchased for $300. He tried to protect it against rust, not too successfully, with a thick blue Earl Scheib paint job. "What a beast," my mom declared after seeing Dad's handiwork. We then decided to nickname it the Blue Crush, after the all-girl surf movie. That and the fact that we always crush everything into it, family, friends, and gear. Our car may be junky, but at least the stereo works well. My brothers and I are all into music. I like Switchfoot, 12 Stones, and modern worship music. My mom likes it too. On this morning, we decided to put in a CD by the David Crowder Band. I turned it up when the song Oh Praise Him started playing. "Just don't blast it," Mom reminded me. "We don't want to wake up the whole neighborhood." We splashed through a lot of puddles left over from the rain as we drove slowly along our North Shore town called Princeville. It was quiet and pitch black as we headed down the windy road that leads from the bluffs to the surf spots in and around Hanalei Bay. We clattered across the old one-car steel bridge that marks the official start of the North Shore. The bridge is too narrow and low for big trucks, so this part of the island has only cars on the road. Sometimes heavy rains close this bridge, stranding everyone who lives past it. Personally, I think kids who live there don't mind at all. They get to miss school. In the darkness, we pass lots and lots of surf spots. The bay, the bowl, pavilions, pine trees, middles, chicken wings, Waikoko. We were headed for the very end of the road called Pauika. Even though it was dark, with the windows down, we could smell the beauty of Hawaii. Perfumed plumeria and pakaki flowers, the wet earth, grass, and salty air. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes so I could picture it in my mind's eye. Hawaii has this ability to reach out and stir all your senses. It's truly a magical place, and I wouldn't live anywhere else on the planet. I looked over at my mom, who was smiling as well. She felt the same way I did about our home. We drove past the old Waioli church and the mission house where some of the first missionaries to Hawaii lived, worked, and died. Finally, we crossed over a very narrow wood bridge that marked the end of our journey. The calm before the attack. The sun wasn't even up yet. I got out of the car to take a look, but it was too dark to see the water. I couldn't hear much either. If the surf is really big, you can actually hear it crashing on the reef from a long way away. "It doesn't seem like much is happening," I told my mom. Pretty soon the sky east of us began to lighten, and I could see that the surf wasn't anything like it had been the day before. The small waves dumped right onto a sharp coral reef instead of barreling past it. I was itching to get on my board, but the water was just not going to cooperate. If you surf a lot, you get used to this kind of thing. This island has some of the best waves in the world, but my friends and I still get skunked sometimes. There's nothing you can do about it. Just go home and do something else. I guess we should head back, Mom sighed. She was equally disappointed. Maybe the surf will come up tomorrow. I knew that if I didn't surf, I would be home doing social studies, English, or math. Even though I'm working to be a pro surfer and get to be homeschooled in order to help with those goals, my parents pile on the homework. As we were driving away, I gave it one last shot. Let's just check out Tunnels Beach, I suggested. Tunnels is a short walk from Pauika. It's called Tunnels because of all the sand-filled alleys that run through the shallow part of the reef. For tourists, it's a popular place to snorkel. Surfers like it because way out on the edge of the reef is a lightning-fast wave that is good both winter and summer. Sure, we can go take a look, Mom replied. She did a wild U-turn under the trees and pulled into the last space in the parking lot. While she waited, I walked down the little sand path and watched the waves for a while. Still nothing much, and I didn't really want to paddle out by myself. So I figured that I was doomed to schoolwork and trudged back to the Blue Crush. Suddenly, a black pickup truck turned into the parking lot. It was Alana Blanchard, my best friend, her 16-year-old brother Byron, and her dad, Holt. They, like me, were on a mission to find something to surf in. Okay, I thought. Maybe this wouldn't be a total washout after all. Even though the wave conditions were crummy, everything else was working. It was sunny, the water was warm, and my friends were here to hang with. Can I stay, Mom? I asked. We think we'll paddle out for some small waves. Why not make the best of it? Just make sure Holt brings you home, she called. And with that, I raced down the jungle trail with my friends to Tunnels Beach. I dug my toes into the warm sand and watched the rising sun illuminate the blue sea. Amazingly, the rain hadn't clouded the waters here. Even with all mud-filled rivers pouring into other surf spots, it was as clear as glass. I glanced over to see Holt putting wax on his board to keep his feet from slipping. I put the surfboard leash on my left foot and my Tim Carroll surfboard under my arm. I was happy that I was going surfing. I was happy to be with my friends. I felt the warm water slosh against my ankles, and just before I jumped in, I looked at my watch. It was 6:40 on a beautiful Halloween morning. Chapter 2. Roots. A lot of who I am comes from my parents. They're incredible people who've always worked very hard to reach their goals. I know a lot of teenagers think their parents are total aliens from another planet, but I actually think mine are pretty cool. They not only support me in everything I want to do, but they also really inspire me to be a great surfer, and even more important, a great human being. My dad was the ultimate surfer nut. Picture this. When I do, it cracks me up. It's the dead of winter in Ocean City, New Jersey. Icicles are hanging from the edges of buildings, and the snow is swirling around the sidewalks, rapidly burying the curbs and making huge mounds against the buildings. Everyone is bundled against the cold and scraping the ice off their car windows. Along comes my dad, Tom Hamilton, this skinny 17-year-old, trudging through the snowbanks with a surfboard on his head and his beaver tail hat, a la Davy Crockett, flapping behind him. Dressed in a primitive, thick, black diving wetsuit, he would grease his armpits with thick Vaseline to ward off wetsuit rash. And looking like the creature from the Black Lagoon, he would head out, blizzard and all, to his favorite Ocean City surf spot, 10th Street. There, he'd meet up with his best buddy, Monk, and the two of them would cross a deserted beach, frosted white, to surf the icy gray Atlantic in conditions so severe that their eyebrows would often freeze solid. Tom and Monk started surfing together as little kids, around age 13 or 14 in the summer of 1962. Within a few years, both boys were dedicated fanatics who took their sports seriously year-round. In winter, we would do anything we could think of to keep warm, my dad has told me. There were no leashes on surfboards, so if you fell off during the winter months, the swim to the beach was brutally cold. We came up with the idea to pour hot water down our wetsuits before going surfing to give us a little edge in the cold. We would be steaming like tea kettles all the way to the beach. I always wondered how my dad knew he was born to be a surfer. When I ask him, he says it was more like destiny took him by the hand and led him to the waves. His parents, George and Mary Hamilton, moved with their four kids around New Jersey a few times before settling in Ocean City. While George set up his dental practice, Mary made sure that my dad and his two brothers and his sister were deeply involved in the sport of swimming. One day, my grandpa, Dr. George, brought home a surfboard for my dad. It was a factory-produced pop-out model, as opposed to a normal hand-shaped surfboard, that was on sale at, of all places, a hardware store. One try, and my dad was hooked. Soon, he and Monk were part of the regular surf scene on the Jersey Shore. If Grandpa had only known the daily ritual he created. Moving on. In 1968, my dad graduated from Ocean City High School. As a graduation gift, my grandparents sent him to Manhattan Beach, California, so he could spend the summer surfing. This was the best gift he could ever have imagined. There, he prowled up and down the coast, tasting firsthand the waves he had only heard about in magazines. But there was a war on. Student deferments were ending, and 18-year-old boys everywhere were being drafted and shipped off to the jungles of Vietnam. My dad, hoping that he could find a way to stay around and surf a bit more, joined the reserves, but found his unit quickly activated. So hoping to stick close to the water, he enlisted in the Navy. In 1970, he was sent to Vietnam, and his job was to blast the ship's big guns in support of troop movements. That powerful noise would damage his hearing for life. And though it was not exactly the place that a surfer kid imagined himself winding up, this too proved to be fate. On his ship, Dad met a young sailor named Robbie from Hawaii. Since they both loved surfing, they immediately bonded. Dad was awestruck by the incredible surfing tales Robbie would spin. "When this thing is over," Robbie kept telling him, "you come to Hawaii." During Christmas of 1971, Dad made his first visit to the islands. It was love at first sight. Who could resist the warm tropical trade winds, the transparent, inviting water, the powerful winter waves, and the casual, relaxed lifestyle? "One day," he told Robbie, making a wish on the waves. Because at the time, since he had completed his service, California was home. He settled in San Diego, enrolled in Mesa Junior College, and, of course, spent all of his free time surfing along the reef-lined Sunset Cliff area. But it wasn't easy to keep his mind on his studies. His thoughts were someplace far away. He was consumed with getting back to Hawaii. And after two semesters with my grandparents insisting he had lost his mind, Dad quit school, took the little savings he had from his part-time job, a backpack, and a surfboard, and caught a one-way flight to Hawaii. He ended up on the island of Kauai. From the airport, Dad hitchhiked to the North Shore, catching a ride in the back of an old red pickup truck filled with buckets of pig slop. The jungles outside Hanalei Town had been taken over by a strange breed of hippie surfers. Some, like future world champion Margot Oberg and her husband, Steve, had actually built comfortable and sustainable tree houses out of scrap wood and plastic tarp. Others lived a more gritty existence in mildewing tents or rough makeshift shelters. The place was called Taylor's Camp because the land these squatters lived on was owned by a relative of actress Elizabeth Taylor. My dad was new to Hawaii and admittedly pretty clueless. Anxious to get settled and get surfing, he selected a nice ditch to call home. He built a wooden platform for his tent and went surfing every day at Pauika, tunnels, or at the huge point waves wrapping into Hanalei Bay. But early in rainy season, he learned his first lesson. The ditch was really a dormant riverbed, and when he returned from surfing, he found that his home and all of his belongings had been washed away. A perfect match. A world away. Around the time my dad was thawing out his frostbitten toes in New Jersey, on the other end of the continent, in the warm California sun, my mom, Sherry Lynch, and her older sister, Debbie, were slowly dragging a heavy rented surfboard across the sand in Mission Beach, a funky seafront community just north of San Diego. My mom was just 12, and she could barely wrap her arms around the massive board. She pushed the long, thick hunk of foam and resin toward the horizon, stumbling from time to time in small underwater potholes the current had dug in the sand. When my mom talks about that moment, her first time surfing, it's as if she's living it all over again. For anyone who truly is a surfer, it's the greatest thrill on earth. I like to hear her talk about it, how she did it and how she felt. When the water had reached her waist, she swung the nose of the board toward shore and then awkwardly lumbered on board and started to paddle. A rush of rolling white water picked up the surfboard and raced it toward the sand. She rose to her feet and in a wide beginner stance rode her first and last wave of the day all the way to the beach. "It was a monumental moment in my life," she often tells me, and I know what she means. Surfing is an addiction, a pleasure rush indescribable to anyone who has not experienced it. And when it grabs you, it won't let go. My mom drove her parents crazy with pleas to drive for the 20 minutes down Interstate 8 to the surf rolling in at the foot of Law Street in Pacific Beach. Luckily, my grandparents loved the sand and surf as well. My grandpa, John Lynch, was a football and wrestling coach at San Diego High School. And since his summer schedule was light, it was easy to load up the family, my grandma, Dorothy, mom, and aunts Debbie and Karen, into the car and spend the long summer days at the beach. When not surfing, my mom would snorkel over the kelp-covered reefs of La Jolla searching for legal-sized abalone, which they would pop off the rocks with an ab iron. Mom was a daredevil. Some days she and her sisters would spend the afternoon at Marine Street and join others in the lunatic fringe sport of body womping, a crazy kind of body surfing where if one is not careful, the shallow draining wave will smack its rider into the dry sand bottom with a womp. Back in her day, girl surfers were a rarity. It was a boys' club, mainly because the early surfboards were heavy and unwieldy. Strong swimming skills were mandatory, and leashes were not used. You had to be a real athlete, and she was, to surf with the guys. And frankly, the men didn't mind at all. I never had to carry my heavy yellow 9'6" surfboard to or from the beach, my mom likes to brag. There was always a bunch of boys around who were more than willing to help. When Mom graduated, she moved to Planet Central, for anyone in the hippie surf and weirdo scene, Ocean Beach. But she, too, was on her way to Kauai. After pinballing around Southern California and doing a short-lived detour into the skiing culture of Mammoth Mountain, California, she decided she needed a less hectic lifestyle and a more challenging surf. Kauai, in the early 70s, had not yet been discovered by most tourists, but Hollywood had already come knocking. Elvis made a movie there, Blue Hawaii, in 1961, and in 1958, Mitzi Gaynor and John Kerr used the North Shore as a backdrop for the film version of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical South Pacific. But for the most part, it was slow-paced, rural, and rich in Hawaiian tradition. My mom, tired of traveling alone, had talked a casual friend Chris into joining her on the adventure. She arrived at the small airport in Lihue, her gear unloaded directly in front of her on slanted steel-covered tables. Weighed down with surfboards and backpacks, the pair made their way to the main highway with the intention of hitchhiking the 30 miles to the North Shore. It took 8 hours before a VW van full of surfers finally allowed them to pile in. Mom had some money saved up, so she was able to surf and camp. She immediately found the surfing conditions on Kauai much bigger than anything she was used to in California. She spent her days developing her skill in the large waves and her nights around a campfire with many other surfing expatriates and hippie characters who had migrated to the shores of Kauai. Ladybug and Tunas Get Acquainted. My dad got a job as a banquet waiter at the Kauai Surf Hotel. The hotel was located in the town of Lihue, quite away from his tent on the North Shore. Since he had no car, he would hitchhike to and from work. But getting a ride home late at night was difficult. There were times when he only got halfway home. Shuffling through some small town at 2 a.m, miles from his final location, he would occasionally creep into a local church and sleep on the pews, wrapping himself with the preacher's robe when he got cold. The North Shore is almost like a small town. Everyone comes to know your neighbors. It didn't take long for my dad to notice the pretty blonde who had been given the nickname Ladybug by her fellow surfers. He had a nickname as well. He was called Tunas because he used to swim laps in the ocean during his breaks and work so often that everyone said he was like a tuna fish. But Mom wasn't interested. She had a boyfriend at the time. She and my dad became friends, but that was it. Until one day, Mom will say, "I didn't have a boyfriend anymore." And things started to happen. On the following Valentine's Day, which is also my mom's birthday, Dad popped the question. Your mother burst into tears. Then she married me 6 months later, Dad explains. And it was a given that any children this couple would have would be quickly introduced to the sport that both their parents loved. There was, after all, salt water in the bloodline. Chapter 3, A Serious Competitor. Two brothers. That's my answer when people ask me why I'm so competitive. After all, when you're the youngest of three kids and the only girl, you kind of have to learn to hold your own. But besides the whole anything you can do, I can do better thing going on between us, my brothers really did inspire me. They're both so different. Noah is 21 and a stand-up surfer, just like my mom and dad and me. He's pretty skinny and very quick on the waves. He's also into still photography. He shot most of the great pictures I have of me surfing. What do I admire most about him? When he gets into something, he goes all the way. He is very determined and focused. My brother Timmy is 17, and he enjoys being the odd guy out and the class clown. When Noah got into surfing, Timmy decided to be a bodyboarder. A bodyboard is a hunk of soft foam just over a yard long that's used like a surfboard, except you don't stand up on it. Bodyboards don't have fins on the bottom. They have hard edges that are used to control turns. Bodyboarders wear swim fins to help them catch waves with their small boards. Many stand-up surfers don't give bodyboarders any respect. They call them spongers and ignore them in the water or even try to take waves from them. But a good bodyboarder can really put on an impressive show. They get deeper in the tube than surfers do, take off later, and do crazy aerial stunts. So you can see why Timmy was drawn to it. Crazy stunts are his specialty. Timmy can always crack me up. That's how he is with everyone. He has this natural talent for knowing exactly what to do or say. That one thing that will put a smile on your face no matter how grave or serious the situation. He'll do anything, and I mean anything, for a laugh. For example, after my attack, a national TV show was interviewing him, and he was acting all goofy and grooming his hair on camera. "Who cares if the world thinks I'm nuts?" he told me when I teased him about it. He just wanted to make sure his buddies back home were laughing at Timmy, the maniac on TV. But Timmy's more than just funny. He does all the editing to the hours of video my mom and dad take of me surfing. He gets really creative and puts cool music to the pictures. One tough girl. My brothers play very aggressive sports, such as roller hockey, soccer, and paintball. When people pick sides, everyone wants my brothers on their team because they are so fast and fierce. When I saw them playing all these sports, I, of course, had to play along. I mean, why should they have all the fun? And to their credit, they always let me and never treat me like a little girl. I was one of the boys. And if it meant I got tackled or tumbled or bruised, then that came with the territory. Besides, I could take it. They knew that they could get me to try stuff like inline skating or skateboarding, and I wouldn't back away or cry if I went down. My brothers pushed me to try things that I might not have done on my own. It was my brothers Timmy and Noah who got me to start surfing Poika. Honestly, at the time, it would have been too scary for me without their encouragement and their absolute faith that I could do it. No sweat. My brothers cheer me on and are really rooting for me to become a top woman surfer. My family's like that. When one of us wins a contest or a prize, it's like all of us won. Because we all supported each other and helped get that person to the place where they could win. We are also taught to be good losers. No matter how good you are, sooner or later your team is going to lose. Dad would tell us, "There's no sense in getting upset or being sore. There's always another opportunity to show you can do it." So that's what I try to remind myself if I blow a competition. It's over. Move on. Tomorrow's another day. Even though I've surfed ever since I was 5 years old, I played other sports too. I started soccer when I was in the first grade with a team of North Shore girls. For a long time, I was put in a defensive position, a sweeper. At first, I was disappointed. I desperately wanted to be the one to score the goal during the game. Then I realized that the coach put me where I was for a reason. I had quick reflexes and was a good blocker. One thing I learned about team sports, no one job is more important than the others. You all have to work together. I played soccer for 6 years before getting the chance to score that goal. That's a long time, I know, but it just made scoring even sweeter. my first big win. My parents started signing me up for surf competitions while I was still in grade school. Most of these contests were push and ride types of competitions where a parent will push the kid into the wave instead of the kid having to try and catch the wave themselves. By the time I was 7 years old, I was able to surf and catch waves without my parents' help. I still needed to be coached, but I was getting better and better every day. With my parents' support, I decided to enter the Rel Sun contest on the island of Oahu. This was big, especially for an 8-year-old kid. Traveling around the state of Hawaii isn't all that easy or cheap. We had to come up with the money for the entry fee, airline tickets, car rental, food, and hotel costs. And unlike with golf or some other sport, if you win, there's little or no money, especially in the kid and girl divisions. The contest was being held at Makaha Beach. There were lots of great surfers there, and as I looked around, I felt super excited to be with everyone. The surfing community, especially in the kids' division, is like one big happy family. The waves were big, and I could feel the adrenaline rush. A lot of young kids get intimidated when the surf starts getting huge. Me? I live for it. The bigger, the better. Makaha was not a place I had ever surfed before, and that gave the advantage to local kids who knew the spot better. But I didn't let that scare me either. I entered in two divisions, the girls ages 7 to 9 shortboard and the 7 to 9 longboard. The oldest kid in the contest was 12, because the Rel Sun contest is designed to be for kids under 13, or groms as they're called in the surfing world. One of the girls surfing that day, Carissa Moore, was really good, and I admired her toughness. She would have won the contest, but she had an accident that actually put a deep cut on her throat with the fin of her surfboard. We were at the contest with a bunch of other Christian families, so we all got together and prayed for her. Things get rolling. Then it was time for my heat. My mom told me where to take off. I surfed pretty well that day and ended up winning all my heats and the division championships. My prize, other than trophies, was two brand new surfboards. Guys who were surf legends presented me with them while my friends and family gathered around and cheered. I was pretty stoked, and I remember thinking, is this really happening to me? Winning that contest kind of got things rolling for me. I entered more and more contests and did pretty well in most of them. I entered the Halewa Menahuni contest, which is held on the famous north shore of Oahu. Menahunis are a legendary race of little bitty people in Hawaiian folklore. I found that I was competing against the same kids as before, which was great, because we all got to know each other, and I made some great new friends. These contests, while competitive in the water, are actually fun, happy events where winning is secondary to enjoying the surf, the beach, and all the companionship. And no one really gets cocky like in other competitive sports. There's no, I'm the best and you can't touch me. Because we all know so many things can happen while you're in the water. Nature can play games with you, or your timing can simply be off. So anyone can take home a trophy, and if you lose, there's always tomorrow. A lot of times I have to surf in the same heat as my friend Alana. We both try hard to beat each other. There are never any hard feelings from the one that loses, and we're happy for each other if she wins. It's just a sport, nothing to get all stressed out about. Today, I have the same attitude. Although as I get older, the contest scene gets a bit more intense. The stakes are higher. Bigger money, more sponsorship, and endorsement deals. As I started winning more contests, it seemed possible that I might be able to become a professional surfer as a couple of other girls from my island have done. At least my parents and my brothers thought so. I didn't let my head go there right away. Instead, I just wanted to enjoy the moments while I was living them and not worry too much about the future. My brother Noah became my promoter. He created a great resume for me and mailed it off to various surf companies. He set up websites and computer programs. He takes photos and even helps me with surfboard design so that I will get a board made specifically for the kind of surfing I do. He contacted surf gear and clothing companies, and he sent promotional packs to anyone in the surfing industry he could think of. Since he loves surf photography and went to college to study business, he's a natural salesman. He was the one who helped me get my sponsor, Rip Curl. People ask me all the time my secret to winning a competition. Beats me. All I can tell you is that it's a combination of perfecting your skill and keeping a positive outlook. I don't get nervous or stressed out before a contest. In fact, other than going out and surfing the spot before the contest, I don't even think about it much. I study the waves briefly before a contest to help me plot my strategy. Based on what I observe, I pick out a marker on the beach to line up with and figure out the best place to take off. Sometimes I make a bad move, and when I do, I lose a heat as a result. I have to admit, I get bummed out and down on myself.
"Bethany, you have to get over it," my dad'll tell me.
So I take his advice and try to shake it off so that I can focus on what's ahead. He's also taught me the importance of learning from my mistakes. I make sure to break any bad habits before they begin. Because I'm still an amateur, I don't get money for winning a contest, but I do have the opportunity to make money from my sponsors if I place high. But dollar signs aren't what it's all about for me. Once in a while, someone forgets that a surf contest is really about having fun, and that really spoils it for everyone. I hate to feel that negative energy. At one contest, a dad was screaming at his daughter because she wasn't surfing well. I felt really bad for her. What does that accomplish anyway? Wouldn't a little encouragement have worked better? My family's great on that front. They're my number one fans. Win or lose, they think I'm awesome. And I know I have their love and support no matter how I place in a contest. Both my folks just dabbled in competition, and neither of my brothers cares to enter contests. So I guess that makes me the star competitor in the family. Not that it gets me out of doing my chores at home. My favorite surf spots are Pine Trees, Hanalei Kauai, Hawaii, Trussels, San Clemente, California, Bell's Torquay, Australia, Popoya Santana, Nicaragua, and my favorite, Hanalei Pier in Kauai, where I learned. Make way for women. More and more girls have started surfing, which means that they're finally being taken seriously as athletes and can actually make a living at this sport, something that was nearly impossible a decade ago. Today, there are even magazines aimed specifically toward women surfers. Women on the Pro Surf Tour are a very tight-knit bunch, and they're all very dedicated. The girls on the amateur circuit, which is what I surf, are on pretty good terms as well, although there are a lot more of us nowadays, so I can't say I'm tight with everyone just yet, but I love to meet new people and get to know them. I don't know what other girls do before they go out in a heat, but for me, the routine is pretty simple. I pray. I pray for safety for everyone, and I pray for wisdom in my wave selection and the ability to be at the right place at the right time. People often ask me if I had ever been hurt surfing before my accident. Actually, surfing is a pretty safe sport. If you fall, you hit water, which is much better than, say, being a skateboarder and smacking down on the hard pavement. Once or twice I got held down for a long time in a big surf. This is not really the same as getting hurt, but for a few minutes you become a little panicky and the thought, "I might drown," enters your mind. Then the wave lets you up again, and you can breathe and you forget you were scared. Most surfers get injured from their own surfboard or someone else's board. Once I was playing in the shore break and got slammed by my board. It hurt so bad that I stayed out of the water for several days. You know it would take a lot to keep me from surfing. I was one big bruise. Other times, a big wave will bounce you off the bottom, and if the bottom happens to be coral, well, let's just say that you're not a pretty sight with all those cuts and slices. Bumps, bruises, reef rash, hey, it comes with the territory. I'll take it all and then some, as long as I can surf. Chapter 4, A Mostly Normal Life. I have a mostly normal life. Mostly normal because I have a lot of the same interests as most 14-year-olds. Music, movies, and driving my older brothers crazy. But in some ways, my life is pretty different. Take, for instance, living 3,000 miles from the rest of the United States. Having a home on a tiny island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean isn't for everybody. There are no big shopping malls, only a couple of movie theaters, no ice skating rinks, no miniature golf or go-kart places. We have only one road to get around on, and if there's a traffic accident, half the island can be blocked from getting anywhere for a long, long time. It's such a small place that you get to know lots of people and can have friends all over the island. We always joke that if a kid gets in trouble in school, the parents know about it before the kid gets off the school bus. But the smallness also has its advantages. If your car breaks down on the side of the road, chances are good that someone you know will come by real soon and help you out. People who have lived their whole life in a big city don't always understand what my life here is like, or why I wouldn't want to, say, move to LA or New York or some other fast-paced city where there's lots of action and excitement. Here's what I think. You make your own adventure in life. And I truly believe that if you open your eyes to your surroundings, there's lots of neat stuff to be found practically anywhere on Earth. For me, the grass is never greener outside of Hawaii. If you ask me my favorite things about my home, I can think of dozens, but my top three are pretty easy. Number one, it's never cold. I wear shorts and a t-shirt almost all year long. It's even warm at Christmas time. In fact, our family Christmas tradition is to get up early and go surfing and then come back and open gifts. We like to do this because there are almost always good waves that time of year, and the best surf spots are uncrowded because everyone else is home looking under the tree. Number two, there's always something to do, especially if you love the sand and surf like I do. When there are no waves or when I'm done surfing, I like to pick shells on the beach, snorkel on the reef, swim around with sea turtles, or go swimming at a natural lava rock swimming pool called Queen's Bath, which is filled every high tide with salt water. Sometimes my friends and I hike to the waterfall at Hanakapiai. Number three, bananas and papayas. They grow all over the place here, even in my backyard.